In a moment, Living in an Atomic Age. Stay tuned. The Great Fraud is a timely series of reports by Mrs. Ada Siegel, authority on the USSR and its people, which exposes the way the Soviet government constantly defrauds its citizens. Mrs. Siegel reveals false items printed in Pravda and Izvestia, the two principal organs of the Soviet press, explaining the purpose of the Soviet government in misinforming its people. She reports USSR developments in domestic and international policies since the death of Premier Stalin and includes a forecast of future trends under the Malenkov regime. Don't miss The Great Fraud later this evening on ABC. In cooperation with the British Broadcasting Corporation, the Public Affairs Department of the American Broadcasting Company presents transcribed the last in a series of six lectures entitled Living in an Atomic Age by the distinguished English philosopher, mathematician, sociologist, and author Bertrand Russell. The subject of the last lecture is The Achievement of Harmony. Lord Russell.
I have been concerned in these lectures to set forth certain facts and certain hopes which these facts render rational. The facts concern the unification of mankind through modern technique and the liberation of mankind from bondage to excessive toil, which the inadequate techniques of the past rendered unavoidable. The hopes that are based upon these facts are hopes as to the general well-being that may be realized if mankind learn to practice the cooperation which modern techniques demand. There are, it is true, correlative fears, for which there is perhaps as good basis in the present state of the world as for the hopes that I have been setting forth. The technical unification of the world not only makes possible much greater general well-being than at any former time, if it is accompanied by economic and political unification, it also makes possible greater disasters than any known to even the worst of former times, if our technical skill continues to be devoted to disunity rather than unity. I have not, however, in these lectures, dwelt much upon the reasons for fear, since I do not think that it is through fear that we shall avoid the dangers that threaten us. Our world has too much of fear, and emphasis upon dangers is apt to lead to apathetic despair. What our world needs is the opposite. It needs rational, creative hope. It needs something positive to live for. It needs yes feelings rather than no feelings. If the yes feelings are as strong as a purely rational consideration allows them to be, the no feelings will melt away and become unnecessary. But if we dwell upon no feelings too much, we shall never emerge from despair. Let us allow ourselves to assume that mankind, whether through the lessons of a Third World War or through some less painful process, will have come to understand the community of interest which unites the human family. Let us consider what public institutions can do to bring about a happy issue in the three age-long conflicts of men, with nature, with each other, and with themselves. Let us begin with the conflict with nature. There will have to be an international authority controlling the production and distribution of food and raw materials. This authority must have power to prevent such wasteful agricultural methods as have produced the deserts in North Africa and the Dust Bowl in the United States. I come now to the conflicts of man with man. Here, the first thing to be coped with is war. While mankind are subject to the threat of war, especially by the deadly methods which science is perfecting, nothing good can be secure. There is only one way of making the world safe against war, and that is to have only one armed force in the world. When this has been achieved, there will no longer be danger of serious wars, unless they were to take the form of civil wars between different parts of the international force. To prevent this, measures which are not purely military will be required. There will need to be control over education, in the sense that no country must be allowed in its schools to teach a predatory nationalism. The teaching of history everywhere should lay more stress upon the progress of man than upon national victories or defeats in contests with other nations. There should be interchange of students, so that many people, while still young enough to be not hardened in habits and prejudices, should become intimate with people of other countries and with their ways of thought and behavior. The edifice of internationalism in education should have at its apex an international university, open to able students from all countries, containing professors to whom the international ideal appeared important, and affording a refuge to able men who, like Einstein, were found displeasing to their compatriots for reasons disgraceful to those compatriots. I come last to the protection of the individual, both against the hostility of the herd and against his own fears. These two are more closely connected than is sometimes thought, for herd hostility is usually the result of fear, and the fear that it expresses, though nominally directed outwards, has, as a rule, its root in a fear which the intolerant individuals feel of a part of themselves. Education in the very early years can do much to prevent the growth of underground terrors, such as psychoanalysis lays bare. Affection and security are what is mainly needed in the early years. A population wisely handled in youth will be less liable to herd hostilities than is now common in most parts of the world. Nevertheless, it must be expected that herd hostilities will be sometimes aroused in cases in which, to the outsider, there seems no just ground for such hostilities. The best way of dealing with these cases would be to provide places of sanctuary, as was done in the Middle Ages. Those who had fled to such places should be examined by a neutral authority and should be protected if that authority pronounced them blameless. Regimentation and uniformity are dangers that an organized industrial world will have to fear, and against which it should take deliberate measures. There should be opportunities for exceptional individuals, such as poets and artists, who would be likely to fail in any attempt to win the approval of elderly bureaucrats. I should have academies for such men, not as a reward for achieved eminence, for then it is too late, but as expressing the favorable opinion of young men engaged in similar pursuits. I would have election to such academies only possible for men under 25, and I would confine the voting for election to members of the academy concerned who were still under 35. Such regulations might make it possible for the academy not to become an ossified collection of old fogies, as academies too often are. There should be for everybody considerably shorter hours of work than are now customary, and much longer holidays than are now enjoyed by anybody except university professors. Some people are afraid that in such a community life would be too tame and unadventurous, but this need not be the case. There are innumerable forms of adventure which could be open to everybody who desired them, if holidays were as long as they easily might be. For those who like danger, there should be every facility for opportunities of risking their lives, provided they did not at the same time risk the lives of those who prefer a less exciting existence. For those who wish at all times to live strenuously, and to whom a soft life feels disgusting, it should be possible to find a quite sufficient outlet in some really difficult work, whether of artistic creation or of scientific research. Such work stretches men's powers to the very utmost, as much in its way as an attempt to climb Everest. But for those who do not find it adequate, Everest still remains to be conquered. No society can be great without great individuals, and I should not think much of a world which had secured universal safety at the price of universal mediocrity. I think, however, that universal security, if it were attained by the kind of means that I have spoken of, would so much diminish envy and fear of eccentricity that the recognition, even in the young, of possible exceptional merit would not encounter the psychological resistance which it now has to meet in the great majority of mankind. If this is indeed the case, if such institutions as I have spoken of can be established, the happy world that I am envisaging can be not only happy, but glorious. I cannot believe that what is dark and dreadful and destructive in the souls of men is essential to the production of great works of imagination. I believe, on the contrary, that it lies within the power of man to create edifices of shining splendor from which the glory and greatness of which human thought and feeling are capable shall spread a light unmixed with darkness, filling men's hearts with joy and their thoughts with clarity. Such a world is possible. It rests with men to choose whether they will create it or allow the human race to perish in anger and sordid hate. Man, in the long ages since he descended from the trees, has passed arduously and perilously through a vast, dusty desert, surrounded by the whitening bones of those who have perished by the way, maddened by hunger and thirst, by fear of wild beasts, by dread of enemies, not only living enemies, but specters of dead rivals, projected onto the dangerous world by the intensity of his own fears. At last, he has emerged from the desert into a smiling land. But in the long night, he has forgotten how to smile. We cannot believe in the brightness of the morning. We think it trivial and deceptive. We cling to old myths that allow us to go on living with fear and hate. Above all, hate of ourselves, miserable sinners. This is folly. Man now needs for his salvation only one thing: to open his heart to joy and leave fear to gibber through the glimmering darkness of a forgotten past. He must lift up his eyes and say, "No, I am not a miserable sinner. I am a being who, by a long and arduous road, have discovered how to make intelligence master natural obstacles, how to live in freedom and joy, at peace with myself, and therefore with all mankind." This will happen if men will choose joy rather than sorrow. If not, eternal death will bury men in deserved oblivion.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have just heard the last in a series of six lectures by Bertrand Russell entitled Living in an Atomic Age. This has been a transcribed feature of the Public Affairs Department of ABC in cooperation with the British Broadcasting Corporation. Besides our fighting men in Korea, we have thousands of hospitalized veterans fighting for life. Your blood can help them. In addition, there is a daily demand for blood in civilian hospitals. And beyond all this, we need to build blood plasma reserves against the possibility of disaster or enemy attack. To meet and coordinate these needs, a national blood program has been set up with the Department of Defense, Civil Defense, and the Red Cross cooperating. You can help. Phone your local Red Cross for an appointment. It's easy and painless. Americans are rolling up their sleeves. Join them, won't you? This program came from New York.